Welcome to the Command Line Podcast for February 18th, 2013. I'm your host, Thomas Command Line Gideon, a self-proclaimed hacker, eccentric, and hacktivist. This is my show about the practice and profession of programming, drawing on well over a decade of professional experience and a lifetime spent hacking, the intersection of technology with society and public policy, and anything else clever, elegant, or funny that catches my mind as a diehard technology geek. This episode is a feature cast. In it, as promised, I have a new installment in the series How This Hacker Sees the World, this time on, recursively enough, the subject of hackers themselves. I hope that this will just be the start of a contemplation, a much deeper, more rigorous contemplation of this definition of this subject, one that's so very near and dear to my heart. I also have a new hacker word of the week. First, before I get into that, I did want to share just a couple of quick gadget reviews. I know this is a little bit atypical, but I get to use the intro pretty much for whatever is on my mind and want to talk about for a couple of minutes. And actually, this is continuous with a piece that I did that you'll find in the archives titled Upgrading to Android. And the continuation is that I've decided to experiment with not hauling my full notebook computer around, my Lenovo T40S, that I do still love dearly, and for a road warrior machine, it's great, but I find myself coding less and less these days, and really need something that's more about communications and note-taking. And the note-taking that I'm interested in is with a full keyboard, and it's in a very particular editor. I'm so habituated to Vim that I actually have a Vim Touch on Android. I really love it, but it really does demand a keyboard, so I've been looking for a good complement in that regard. And I found one on a wish list on a website that some friends of mine run with an associated podcast that's The Secret Layer. So leading up to the holiday season, last season, one of the regular contributors mentioned this mini suite keyboard made specifically for the Nexus 7. So it's Bluetooth, which is great. It's very low draw, USB rechargeable. It's just standard out of the box. You just turn it on, you pair it with the tablet, and it works great. The design of this, I have to say, is really nice because it's matched quite well to the aesthetic of the Nexus 7. It looks like it was actually made by Asus and Google, made exactly for it. Well, it was. It just wasn't made by the original manufacturer. And it provides a nice hard case when the keyboard's not in use that covers the screen and looks on the case side exactly like the same trim and materials as the grippy backside of the Nexus 7 and the nice silverized edge on the bezel there. In terms of the keyboard, it does require a little bit of adjustment for someone my size with larger hands, but I was surprised at how quickly I became accustomed to typing on that keyboard. The only other drawback that I have with it is that it is missing a couple of keys that I consider to be essential, but honestly, there are good hacks. There are things that don't even require rooting that allow remapping of hardware keyboards in Android that actually make that a very addressable complaint. So overall, at just under, $22 inclusive of shipping, I found it to be an excellent deal. We'll see how well it actually wears being kept in a bag and toted day in and day out. So far, there's a little bit of discoloration, I'll be honest, in the silver. It's yellowing a little bit, but not all that noticeably. I don't think that's much cause for complaint. If it holds up, even for 6 months, I think that $20, just north of $20 price point, means that I could buy another one and another one and another one and not feel too badly about that. The other thing that I got to make up for the fact that I also often use my Lenovo as a bit of a spare battery to charge devices is I got a Revive Solar battery. So this is actually a standard battery that charges off of USB or mains and will do so in about 8 hours to full charge, but also has a solar panel on the back. That panel takes about 13 hours, so it's something that's going to take about 2 days solid of charging in the sun, but it does have suction cups and other ways of mounting it, setting it up so you could put it like in a car window if you're traveling or out camping or something like that. And the capacity of the battery itself is such that fully charged, I can completely recharge my Nexus 7, I can completely recharge my Samsung S2 Android phone, and still have enough left in the battery to juice up some wireless earbuds that I've started carrying, or even the Bluetooth keyboard. So I'll include links to both of those for who are curious about those in the show notes who have either a Nexus 7 or are looking for something comparable. And I'll just also make clear that in this instance, these are not review units. These are ones that I was looking to purchase on my own for very specific needs. I bought them for my own purposes. So this is just my genuine review of a bit of kit that I'm trying out to see if, in combination with something I've been delighted with, this Nexus 7 tablet, if in a non-coding workload environment, if they can take over from the series of laptops that I've had now for quite some years, but as I get older, I'll admit, being a little bit harder on my shoulder and on my back. The hacker word of the week comes from The Jargon File, maintained by Eric Raymond at catb.org. Frink, verb. The unknown, verb. Fill in your own meaning. Found especially on the Usenet newsgroup alt.fan.lemurs, where it is said that the lemurs know what frink means, but they aren't telling. Compare Goritz. This is a topic that in various forms has been in my mind for a while. I haven't grappled with it on mic to date because it's genuinely a difficult topic for me. While I describe myself as a hacker, I can't say I've really thought about what that label means concretely and why I feel it fits. When talking with friends who do not identify as hackers, the very term hacker clearly conjures any number of images to their minds. Judging by the questions they ask and the statements they make, the understanding they have clearly overlap only minimally with my own experiences. I can't promise to produce a detailed, concrete definition. This essay is more of an exercise in trying to reveal my own assumptions in a way that can then perhaps be more rigorously addressed in terms of more consistently applying at least one variation of the concept of hacker. At least part of my own thinking is informed by my reaction to not just the views of my acquaintances, but to the cultural reception of hacking and what I suppose it means in terms of the understanding of it any random person on the street is likely to have. Popular culture and media often associate hackers with criminals who happen to use computers. Sometimes this is as simple as a bogeyman, a nameless dread to coincide with mainstream ignorance of computer networking. This particular instance is the easiest to pick apart, as it is often riddled even with the internal inconsistencies, let alone incorrect facts about how computers work and programming is practiced. Other times, the popular take on hackers is a caricature sketched in from a few brief glances of limited insight. This may draw upon actual encounters with hacker culture, such as user groups, conferences, or even historical stereotypes. More often, I suspect that they rely on secondhand information that has been distorted by the retelling, especially when it comes more from received wisdom than even indirect experience, as indicated by statements such as "everybody knows" or "they say." In reality, those of us who identify with the idea of hacking are incredibly diverse and difficult to pin down with a narrow set of common characteristics. Often, the idea of a hacker is like the Supreme Court view of certain phenomena, that is, we know it when we see it. I will try to bring forward at least a few first-hand observations from my own experience, though these again will be heavily mediated by the limits of that same experience. I may refer to the writings of some credible observers, and will try to name those and gut-check them as much as possible against my own limited set of data. The clearest trait I have seen firsthand in hackers is their curiosity. I've had conversation after conversation over the years where a hacker-inclined friend or acquaintance will pitch some idea, the genesis of which is something like, "Have you ever wondered if?" The completion of that sentiment may be a simple interrogative about something about which most people are ignorant, like traffic lights or radio frequency security fobs. Sometimes that ignorance is intentional, as with security systems, where those responsible may think keeping knowledge hidden serves some good. Other times, maybe the majority of times, the ignorance in question arises from most people just taking the world around them largely for granted. Some of my earliest recollections of the latter are my dad telling me about how engines work. Internal combustion engines are one thing whose operation cannot easily be deduced by watching. I claim no expertise here, having never followed up on this conversation with my dad by joining him in the garage actually taking apart and working on engines. My point is just the simple joy at acquiring knowledge about which an everyday thing that I otherwise previously took for granted without a second thought. Without getting into computers, there are any number of other such subjects, many of which, like cars, have devoted followings that themselves are very hacker-like. Among the hackers I've encountered, this keen sense of curiosity is often satisfied by simply reading up on a subject. Another good example, which I may have shared in another vein, is my eldest son. Not surprisingly, given my own interests, he very much enjoys video games. He noticed in several of them, mostly in supernatural or horror-themed ones, some common characters and design elements not fully explained within the games themselves. On some level, he appreciated there was some implicit knowledge he hadn't yet acquired. After researching online for a while, he realized in this case it was Dante's Inferno that was being heavily referenced in a few games. What he did next, to me, speaks to what distinguishes the kind of curiosity a hacker possesses from the more quotidian kind. Entirely on his own, he purchased a copy of the source material to read to complete his own knowledge. I know a lot of people who have pursued this level of knowledge all the way into academia, driven by what is clearly a pure, naked curiosity, feeling only such deep study will sate it. Even reading can be elevated to an amazing degree when driven by deep enough curiosity, in that it eventually leads to not just knowledge acquisition, but synthesis, and from there, new knowledge and arguably even new insight. What is key here is how the curiosity in question drives someone to act on it. For me, there are tons of examples that revolve around acting on knowledge in some form of practice. The example of learning from my dad is one instance where I don't think I acted very hacker-like, missing an opportunity to acquire practical as well as in-depth knowledge. Another one of my passions is a good positive example, brewing. This is a craft that requires the curiosity to learn, but is definitely fulfilled most in the doing, not the least because the products themselves are an experience in sense and enjoyment. That being said, I have encountered plenty of people curious enough to read up who never actually brewed a drop for any number of excuses, but really only one reason, failing to realize they didn't need anyone's permission to try. It does reinforce a difference in kind between mere curiosity and a burning need to know. The latter may lead to some impressive feats of research and synthesis, but also often reaches an intense pinnacle in recreating ways of doing things. Computer hacking commonly is differentiated by acting on machines to see what they do, given that the only requirement to act is access to a computer. I've seen some academics, like Dana Boyd, discuss this in terms of power or control. That certainly makes sense for those in situations where they otherwise lack power. There is also a simple, visceral joy in just making a computer react in non-obvious ways. That could be in response to writing a new program, seeing an original idea actually working, or, as is more commonly described by the likes of Stirling and Levy, in exposing the hidden actions of systems all around us, again about which we are ignorant because we so often take them for granted. I would be very careful to frame the exertion of knowledge as its own reward, whether it is the fraught example of breaking or subverting a system, or in the simple expression of building new things, either in code or in a workshop. The joy in seeing not just knowledge in action, but hard-won knowledge, is hard to describe, but often easy to demonstrate in events like Hack Labs or Discotechs, which is short for Discovering Technology if you've not heard that term before. I think hackers are so hard to define meaningfully because they really are deeply ambiguous. An earlier essay in this series tried to tackle the notion of meritocracy. In reading Gabriella Coleman's book, Coding Freedom, I realized another piece of this puzzle. she very clearly identifies a tension between individualism and collectivism amongst hackers. I've seen, on my own, evidence of this at work, the recognition of shared value inherent in collaborative, free, libre, and open source projects, at odds with the desire of each contributor to demonstrate their own individual effort and value. Reading her work on the subject, I realized that this is hardly an either-or situation. One does not consistently trump the other. Both are equally valued if difficult to reconcile together. In the mailing lists and other fora I've inhabited over the years, I've seen this dynamic play out over and over again. Some of the more dramatic examples of narrative history, in one of my recent pieces again in the series, in retrospect clearly involved this conflict, trying to advance both a broad goal and an individual's role within it. I hope you'll forgive my vagueness, now as then, but I think there are enough examples, without naming names, to find any number of comparable and corroborating incidents. Another ambiguity I've encountered is thrown into stark relief by the common view that those of us who work with technology, computers in particular, are dryly analytical. This is an understandable mistake arising from perceptions of how computers work. While computers are deeply logical, most people who don't program them assume this means a straightforward logic, if this, then that. At their very lowest levels, this is certainly true as the atomic components, logic gates, are entirely unambiguous in how they work. Like an understanding of even classical Newtonian physics, let alone relativity or quantum mechanics, the larger a system becomes, the harder it is to predict, even with clear, simple first principles. There are billions, if not trillions, of physical gates in a modern CPU, meaning the ways they are able to interact through programming are effectively infinite. At a higher level, software reintroduces some first principles that, on the face, are similarly logical. The same scale of complexity very quickly arises when source code itself runs up through the thousands or even millions of lines of text. Based on my lifetime of programming computers, I believe it is at least equal parts logic and art. Clear logic may inform very small-scale contained problems, but at practical scales, intuition and prior experience govern, much as they do when a painter tackles a portrait or a composer a sophisticated score. There are the simple tools of technical craft that require a developed aesthetic sense to apply well. I can cite one more example that may help make my point clear. If computers and software arose purely from simple logic given the same starting points, then you would expect programmers and technologists of all stripes to converge a lot more. We wouldn't have multiple operating systems over time and even simultaneously, let alone the jostling crowd of all kinds of apps and applications continually cropping up. The result is far more like a library, museum, or gallery with a diverse array of expression and viewpoint than a dry set of exemplars in some specimen case or book of simple tables. The final ambiguity is the hardest to tackle, the question of transgression. Hacker is often associated closely with criminal computer activities, especially in news coverage. I will admit that it is an unavoidable part of the hacker experience. To my experience, there is not an easily divisible subset of hackers that are criminals, and hence trivial to set aside in some way, to box away. If we want to have larger, more constructive discussions about hacker ethos, culture, and action. In my last newscast, I shared the admission from our respected academic, Edward Tufte, that he was a transgressive phone freaker in his youth. I know I have broken laws more in my youth than since the statute of limitations has run out. If I did so today, any number of these could make me headline fodder, at least for exorbitant copyright case penalties, if not the more troubling instances like Swartz, Manning, and others. The shift in laws and norms is one thing, often in overreaction to the threat of hacker and scare quotes, but I don't think it accounts for enough of what we see here. I think that there is some responsibility on the part of those to whom this label is applied. I do wonder if the routine exploring of the unexamined systems around us poses a risk to hackers of overdeveloping a sense of what is truly arbitrary or absurd versus rational. Even seemingly tame aspects of society, like currency, like the just means of exchange, really are at their base a consensual fiction? Does one then develop one sense of risk when a rule being broken is based on an unpenetrated mystery, as opposed to a different sense of risk after learning how trivially a phone or computer system is even accidentally, unintentionally broken? Maybe this is part of the strong anti-authoritarian streak that I've seen too, and does relate to the question of power and control I mentioned earlier. If the power in question is based on a thin veneer of ignorance, or a system, rules, or set of tools that ultimately are on shaky, logical ground, easily exposed as such, then isn't the difference between a transgressive hacker and a law-abiding one appreciably smaller? Just as hackers are individually all kinds of people, so are we all, I think, each some kind of hacker. Despite the example of my own preoccupation with hacker history and culture, as a group, hackers for the most part aren't entirely hung up on the label. Notice that in many of my own descriptions, I only sometimes referred to computer technology, and if I did, it was as a for instance, not necessarily a prerequisite. Maybe the simplest, clear definition is that driving curiosity with some capacity to act on it. I would much rather leave my own concept more open-ended and hence inclusive, even if it risks including people with whom close association is problematic, than see something I definitely care about deeply used as yet another excuse for divisive us-versus-them type thinking. This kind of curiosity admits not only a broad set of people, but more importantly, begs a staggering diversity in its expression that rightly should invite wonder and wide sharing of many, many different passions in practice. These are just a few, as I admitted, of my exploratory thoughts on what it means to be a hacker, as much as possible grounded in my own experiences. Undoubtedly, you have your own experiences, you have further questions, maybe examples, even counterexamples, that help inform this discussion in meaningful and constructive ways. As always, if you'd like to share those, you can send those to feedback at thecommandline.net, where I'll be happy to share them with everybody else. That's going to do it for this episode. As always, I want to thank you for listening. And if you enjoyed the program, please do tell a friend. Or go to the website at thecommandline.net and click on the support link for all the ways you can financially help out with the production of the show. If you have a question, suggestion, or correction, you can send those to feedback at thecommandline.net, or you can post those as a comment up on the website. If you're away from your computer and the internet at the moment, call the listener comment line at area code 240-949-2638. If you need to get in touch with me securely, details of my public key pair can be found at thecommandline.net/gnupg-fingerprints. The next show in the feed will be a newscast as usual, so until then, don't forget to hack your world. I would like to thank the Internet Archive for media hosting and bandwidth. The views expressed on this program are my own, and where applicable, those of my guests, and in no way reflect those of my employer or anyone else. This show is produced from 100% recycled bits. Except where noted, permission to recycle those further is granted under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 United States license. That means you're free to change this show as much as you like, as long as you don't alter credits, and you share your changes under the same license.